now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Dean Haglund, I am excited to hear how the plans are progressing for your invasion of Melbourne, the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Oh, it's so exciting. I'll be my opening show Thursday, this very Thursday, in previews, and then opening weekend, technically, Friday. So the 25th. The advance ticket sales are good. They're not great, so if you want to get your tickets, get in there now and get them. Go to the Melbourne Comedy Festival to and look up the X-Files improv show and get in and get there and see me live. 10 shows only.
What kind of advertising outreach has there been?
Well, I've done all the radio shows, the morning talk show, the, you know, all that stuff. But because Melbourne Comedy Festival is sort of my co-producer, they have taken the posters and the flyers and sort of done a lot of the footwork there. They also have an interesting thing where if you spend $1,000, you get an interview in the magazine, plus your ads and stuff. I didn't know if that would be cost-effective, this being my very first comedy festival. So I didn't go that route, but... But there's that, of course, the Twitters and the things going to blow up today. That's my whole plan this afternoon. Run that tweets. So how's that? Is that a good marketing plan?
Well, and I mean this podcast.
Oh, and the podcast, of course. What a, you know, this is the one where I'm linchpinning my entire marketing campaign right here on this Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
I think it's wise. Well, I think you. People... within the sound of our voice are already booking their flights and their accommodations in Melbourne. Of course, that would pretty much be limited to Fuzz Aldrin right now because, of course, we pre-record and then put it up the next morning.
Well, Fuzz Aldrin's always welcome.
How have the final warm-up shows, the tune-up shows there in Newtown been going?
They've been going good. Some smaller crowds, but really, really fun, actually. There's something freeing about having a paper laughs scenario where you don't feel obligated because nobody's spent any money yet to actually do, like, you know, you don't feel that you have to go to your hit them out of the park moments. They can really explore and, in fact, find new hit them out of the park moments that you never would have expected. So it's been really, for me, fantastic. I don't know. I think the audience have been enjoying it too. They've all been, you know, nobody's walked out disgruntled for sure. But it's been, the shows have been very, very unique. I'll say that.
Cool, cool. All right. Well, from your comedy shows to, for the first time in quite a while, as far as I can recall, we have an official live event of the week.
Oh.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
That's what I said, Garrett Watley.
Thank you, Garrett Watley.
I went to see the Olivier Award-winning play The Mountaintop at the Matrix on Melrose last night.
The old Matrix still open, is it?
Oh, my goodness. People, actors love it, and I'm not quite sure why. It is a terrible space.
It is a bit of wonky space. I know I saw shows there in the 90s and I thought, oh, this thing is doomed to be torn down because of all the development and the real estate boom going on. I didn't think the Matrix would still be around in this year, 2016.
But it's one of those 99-seat equity waiver houses that actually packs them in. Famous actors have trod through the boards there, continue to do so. I saw The Mountaintop, as I said, which is a play set in a hotel room in Memphis, a two-hander between Martin Luther King and a maid at the hotel where he's staying in Memphis the night before he's assassinated.
The Mountaintop is a classic that has been performed numerous times. So I'm dying to hear how this production went. Normally, the two-hander is kind of just in a plain hotel room. Was there any other production design ingeniousness applied to this one?
There was. Now, it's a little tough to talk about the ingeniousness without giving away a rather major plot twist. He dies in the end. No.
What?
But now you say that this is performed a lot, and
A lot. Let's say I've seen it.
Okay, you have, because I had never seen it. Now it's the playwright is Katori Hall. It's a 2009 play, but this was the West Coast premiere of it that I saw. This is the first production ever on the West Coast, and I found that interesting. We'll talk about the production and the direction of it in a moment. I was curious about how this did get so acclaimed in England, because how do I put this?
Yeah.
I would be very interested if there was a play about race relations in London, how such a play would be received here, where we are outsiders to the intricacies of that story. I can understand why outsiders to the intricacies of the Martin Luther King story might really embrace this piece.
Because
not exactly sure why someone like me, who's well-versed in Dr. King's history, in civil rights history, but also in his personal history and not just his mythology, but the history of the man, I was only intermittently interested in what was going on over the course of 90 minutes.
Oh, really?
No fault of the performers, who were very well cast. Larry Bates, exceptional as Martin Luther King. I'm going to make some comments about the direction, but I do know that this comes back to the script phase. I feel like if this was a play for people who don't know the story, then there are too many jokes that reference things they might not understand without payoff. And if it is for people who know the story quite well, then this 90-minute piece really would have worked better at an hour.
I saw this at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Fascinating.
And I recall it being an hour, not 90 minutes. And it was well cast, but it was, as you said, jokey. Like, there was funny bits to it. And I think the direction I was seeing was, it was emphasizing the funny stuff and just having the background tragedy as just the background looming, that this is a laugh minute riot hour fun fest, but oh, by the way, he gets shot at the end, you know.
So the director is Roger Guinevere Smith, who is an accomplished actor, character actor, appeared in the movie Dope, which hopefully we'll talk about a little later in the show, is the lead in Dan Ringey, my assistant director on Lady Killers. Roger was the lead in his first film, probably still to this day maybe most recognized for his breakout role in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. When I was talking about the direction of it and issuing certain criticisms, it was pointed out to me, why would you expect an actor who's never specific in his choices to be specific in the choices he makes as a director. And that was quite telling.
That is telling. I had no idea that that was... I don't know his acting work all that much, so I don't know his choice range to comment on it. But that is very fascinating.
That was the experience, yeah.
Your working method as an actor, like how specific you are in terms of subtext, like all of that stuff, really then is how you would approach acting or directing, I mean, because it would be the same way you approach a script as an actor is how you would see it and have other actors find it. So I could see that.
Now, we promised last week that we would talk about what we're reading for a few moments, and I thought we could because this is a segue that I really want to make. What are you reading, sir?
Well, I'm still on the biography of Max Sennett, the book called Keystone. Very dense, very thoughtful time of the early silent film comedies. But I also just picked up, as you know, Patty did a corporate retreat, and the new book that's read by all the big industrialists is called Purpose, Finding Your Purpose as a Company and an Individual. And so they did a whole workshop based on this book series. So I've just picked that up in order to find my corporate purpose in terms of my economic throughput. I don't know what the hell. I haven't read all the books, so unless all my jargon's a little off.
Unless there's a chapter like, if you already know your multiple purposes and need to learn better how to juggle them, please advance to chapter. Which brings to mind, how's a certain graphic novel coming along?
Ah, I got the pages right here. I'm looking at the pencils. So excited to reconfigure this whole thing. There's a pile. It's come off out of the filing cabinet onto the desk. That's how advanced we are here.
Out of the filing. I always love that. Out of the frying pan onto the desk. so I'm reading Dan Brown's Inferno.
Oh, yes. This is his latest?
Yeah, I think it was a couple years ago now. And, you know, I'm no big fan of Dan Brown or his writing, although I still maintain Angels and Demons is a terrific book and was probably written by someone else. but Inferno, I am enjoying more than Lost Symbol or Da Vinci Code, largely because of the travelogue tour that it serves as for Florence, Italy.
Ah.
And I bring this up because there's a lot of action that takes place in the Palazzo Vecchio, where the artist Vasari transformed what was at one time the largest room in the world, right? The Hall of 500, I think it's called.
And this was the City Hall of the Grand Republic of the new
In the old city of Florence. Which was the new Republic of Italy.
Yeah.
So it was the Hall of 500, and it was the largest room in the world at the time. And he transformed it, and there's just an incredible bevy of art, including on opposite walls, murals originally by Michelangelo and by Da Vinci, although now apparently they're both by Vasari because he redid so much of them. But
I have a play about that whole.
Well, this is why I brought this up. So if memory served, because you had always told me about the play, and I, not knowing that location. I wasn't aware of all the history surrounding it, so you wrote a play about Michelangelo and Da Vinci being in that hall, almost going against each other, you know, like it was a painting competition on opposite walls. And tell me a little bit about that play.
Well, it's the only time in history the two Renaissance geniuses were ever known to communicate to each other, except for one public insult that a young, arrogant Michelangelo threw at Da Vinci in the courtyard in Florence. And so we knew there's antagonists. They were antagonistic. They were hyper-competitive at that time. Each spurred the other. If you look at the growth of their artwork, you could see how Michelangelo went from just doing single three-dimensional sculptures to, this is one of his early first paintings, where he learned storytelling, learned how to tell a story in a mural, which he could only learn from Da Vinci, and later allowed him to go on to do the Sistine Chapel so amazingly, with using those storytelling techniques. At the same time, you could see Da Vinci abandoning paintings that were done in perspective, and then just placing your characters in that perspective plane, but not having them relate three-dimensionally. Once he learned three-dimensional relation from Michelangelo, he started doing Leda and the Swan, like all of these other paintings that were much more complex in terms of the visual three-dimensional depth of them. So we know they learned from each other at this time. We also know that they were very competitive, that they hated each other, that both were going through a lot of personal issues. Leonardo da Vinci was being sued by his family all through this time. Michelangelo had just completed the David sculpture,
right,
which was placed not in the center of the Republic, but way out of the way, because it was originally called the Republic, and the Medici was coming back, perhaps, as a dictatorial government overlay, and so maybe the Republic would fail. There was all these things, and Da Vinci was on the board of where to decide to put his masterpiece sculpture. Like, there's all these.
So, did you ever complete a draft of this play?
I do have a draft, but what was interesting is I wrote all the dialogue from Michelangelo when I was in my 20s, because I could relate to him, and I was waiting to reach the age of Da Vinci to write all of Da Vinci's dialogue, so I could come at it from the perspective as his end.
Have you reached that age?
I am very close to if not reaching the age, definitely reaching the mindset.
Because let's get that put up.
Yeah, you want that put up? I know John K. Steele in London is very excited. He read an early draft of it. I had Dan Castanella and some of the Second City people workshop a couple scenes from it, which I've recorded, which I'm now going to transcribe.
Yeah, I mean, would think we could get that into some big regional theaters.
Big regional theaters.
So let's talk about that. You got to write that. You got to write Da Vinci's part.
Yes.
Okay.
Very close. It's very close to being done.
And from a play that, from a graphic novel that is on your desk to a play that's very near being done, you have a book that has been published. And it's going to soon be available for sale, right?
Yes.
And I don't know if we've had much of a chance to talk about this, but this is your book that is, it's an illustrated version of your downtown Broadway walking tour, where you have literally created artworks of the buildings with their history beneath.
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah, you know, these buildings are so beautiful when you walk downtown Broadway and you see them individually. Sometimes the detail is overwhelming, so a lot of the pictures that I've done are sometimes just focused on specific parts of it, like the Million Dollar Theater on the stage door side, that kind of thing. But yes, it is the illustrated, I think I call it the illustrated walking tour of Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. And I go in sequential order, starting at the Ace Theater and working your way all the way up to the Bradbury, where it ends. I didn't do City Hall. I added a couple of pictures there, but that seemed overwhelming. So, so this just got published. I just got them shipped on a slow boat to Los Angeles, to the port of Los Angeles, and the books are in boxes waiting for me to arrive to unpack them. So,
right on. Well, so you're in Melbourne Comedy Fest. You are doing your graphic novel. You are going to be completing a big play. And you've got your published book. What the hell don't you do, Dean Haglund, that makes you think you need to find your corporate purpose? Okay.
Just focus all of that. You know,
I hope you appreciate that the what we're reading was all an excuse as a segue to get to your book. Speaking of fantastic segues, we got an email message from Greg Vincent, to whom I offered a shout out and a thank you on last week's show, because he was He was helping me, try to repair some audio equipment. And also, he wanted us to point out what he thought was a very useful feature on our website, i.e. that shows are searchable, that you can enter topics and names and themes. And
right.
It's a very easy way to find shows where we've talked about that. So that's
right.
True. At Chill
and you're
Pack,
thorough on those meta tags.
I try to be, yeah. Chillpackhollywood.com, CHILLPAKHollywood.com. You can do that. Well, we heard from him again this week. He wrote, "Thanks for the shout-out on Monday's show, Phil. Also, very nice tribute to Keith Emerson. Glad to hear you mention his passing. I was a big fan of his music and him when I was growing up."
Right.
Dean's statement that he did not like him was quite moving.
Well, it's good to be honest.
And so once again, from the late Keith Emerson, we derive a fantastic and appropriate segue.
Oh, celebrity deaths.
Because we have some celebrity deaths to talk about.
Right.
Dean Haglund, first of which, Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yes.
A singer and conductor who followed in his famous father's footsteps, died at 72. Quite young.
I know.
Quite young. And he died in Daytona Beach. His sister, Nancy Sinatra, wrote on Facebook that he had died of cardiac arrest while on tour. He had been scheduled to give a concert at the Peabody Auditorium in Daytona Beach with his show Sinatra Sings Sinatra, where he would sing many of his father's classic songs to orchestral accompaniment, tell stories about his father, and show family videos. That actually sounds like a really good show, and I wish I had seen that.
Yeah.
You know, of course he's not going to be the singer that his father was, but it's you get to hear the orchestral accompaniment. Those songs are wonderful to hear, right?
And absolutely, with Nelson Riddle doing the arrangements and using his arrangements there.
And so, and of course, again, Frank Sinatra Jr. was an accomplished orchestra conductor himself, so you expect that the music must have been top-notch. And and then with the stories and the videos, I bet that was a great show. I'm disappointed that
I bet
never
it was a great show. I know from the numerous Frank Sinatra documentaries that I watch continually over and over again. It's a personal aside.
You have found your corporate purpose.
Yes, absolutely. There was a troubled relationship with the father son early on in his younger days, of course, because dad never there, numerous wives and girlfriends, all of that sort of thing would leave a emotional mark on the son. And then, of course, the kidnapping.
Well, we'll talk about this in a moment. Let's.
Is that right?
Born Francis Wayne Sinatra, January 10th, 1944, in Jersey City, New Jersey. He was singing by his early teens. Mm-hmm. When he was 19, he was the singer for Sam Donahue's band, and he also worked with the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Right.
Unlike his father, he never had a hit of his own. He also acted, just like his father, in 1966. He appeared in the movie A Man Called Adam, which starred one of his father's best friends, Sammy Davis Jr. He also played guest starring roles on television shows.
Like The Sopranos.
In 1989, he sang Wedding Vows in Vegas and What Up, Dog on an album by the band Was Not Was. He had a versatile career, all of things, really that don't allow you easily to emerge from the shadow of your father. Not only, arguably the greatest, most successful recording artist of all time, but also an Oscar-winning film actor and producer. So, but you brought up the kidnapping, and this was a very famous case. So many conspiracy theories surrounding it that all ended up being exposed as hooey, but he was kidnapped at the age of 19 in 1963 at Harrah's Lake Tahoe, room 417. Stop by and say hello. He was released 2 days later after his father paid the $240,000 ransom demanded by the kidnappers. So that is such a specific amount, 240. Why 240? Yeah. I mean, did they bargain?
Do you know? No. Originally, he said he wanted $500,000 or even $1 million, but he dropped it down to 240 because that was the amount of debt he was in.
Oh.
So all he needed was to get out of debt.
So this was Barry Keenan, Johnny Irwin, and Joe Amsler were soon captured, prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to long prison terms for kidnapping, of which they served only small portions. Keenan was the mastermind, and he was later adjudged to have been legally insane at the time of the crime, and hence not legally responsible for his actions. So he might have been legally insane, which is why he wanted just the amount he was in debt. But what about the other guys who are going like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't leave any share for us.
I know. I think that was the thing. He originally talked two friends into doing this, not realizing that he needed to get out of a financial dire strait. And why he picked Fred, he actually went to his high school yearbook to see who was famous. And he saw Nancy Sinatra first because they were in the same year together at the high school, but then thought, that might be problematic. So went with the younger brother, Frank, and picked him up.
Wow. And well, my favorite part of it is that they demanded that all communication be conducted by payphone.
Yes.
And during these conversations, because this led to a famous thing for Sinatra, during those conversations, Frank Sr. became so concerned he would not have enough change that it prompted him to carry a roll of dimes with him at all times for the rest of his life.
I didn't know that.
He was even buried with a roll of dimes in his pocket.
Lest the payphones up in heaven don't work.
Yeah. At the time of the kidnapping, Frank Sr. and the Rat Pack were filming Robin and the Seven Hoods.
Mm-hmm.
The stress of the kidnapping, in addition to the assassination of Sinatra's close friend JFK just a few weeks previous, caused him to seriously consider shutting down production completely, though the film was, of course, ultimately completed. We love celebrating character actors on this show. It's been a little while since we've talked about some of our favorites, but we have two, sadly, that we have to remember this week. One was Larry Drake, the Emmy Award-winning actor who portrayed a mentally challenged law clerk on L.A. Law.
Right.
He died of unspecified causes, according to the Associated Press. He was 66, born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He embarked on a Hollywood career that dates back to 1971 with a small role in the film This Stuff'll Kill Ya. Numerous film appearances followed, including 1990's Dark Man, where he was really scary.
Scary in Dark Man.
A starring turn again in a scary film, 1992's Dr. Giggles.
I did not see Dr. Giggles.
But of course,
I did see Bean, of course.
Well, Dr. Giggles was, I think he played like a murderous dentist.
Oh.
And so I love that his film work, you know, he used his fame on L.A. Law to push off into a film career where he got to embody such a totally different energetic, i.e. a very evil and scary one. Right. Which could not have been more different than what than his portrayal of Benny. Was it Stolwitz? Something like that.
Stolwitz?
Benny, I remember, on L.A. Law. The first recurring developmentally disabled character on primetime television.
Oh.
He earned praise for the sensitivity of his performance in the groundbreaking role, which, you know, did tackle real-life issues that an adult with such challenges encounters. And he won consecutive Emmys in 88 and 89. Some of his final performances include a guest starring appearance on Boston Legal in 2008 and a part in 2009's horror thriller Dead Air. And now another really sad one, especially for me, because when I was a kid, there was no one cooler than Jim Garner as Rockford.
Right.
This was a big deal as a kid, the Rockford Files. And
Joe, who didn't want to transcend?
Joe Santos was best known probably for playing Lieutenant Dennis Becker on TV's The Rockford Files alongside James Garner. He died this week, 4 days after having a heart attack. He was 84. In Rockford Files, he always helped Garner's L.A. private eye, and who was an ex-con, right? Jim Rockford, solve crimes on the show all throughout the 70s. And to 80, he received an Emmy nomination for the part, and he played the role also in several made-for-TV movies. He had continuing roles on Police Story, Magnum P.I., Santa Barbara, and The Sopranos.
He did
seven episodes of The Sopranos in 2004 as a consigliere Angelo Greppe.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah, I forgot that's the same guy, actually.
Yeah.
What a range.
Yeah, yeah. Just a real one of those guys. Like, I just, in the 70s, I feel like you couldn't throw a rock without hitting one of these terrific character actors of Italian descent.
Yeah. that always got work, too. That's the thing. These character actors, you were always working back then. Nowadays.
Yeah. His career wasn't limited to small screen. He played various characters in more than two dozen films, including The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight in 1971, The Education of Alison Tate in 86, The Last Boy Scout in 91, and a little independent film that's quite interesting, The Man from Elysian Fields in 2001.
Look at that.
Celebrity deaths for another week. I believe, the Star Trek franchise a mea culpa, Dean Hagland.
Really?
Specifically, I think the forthcoming episodic spinoff that we've talked about that I have been, call it pessimistic.
Right. I'll call it trashing. I'm going to say you're trashing it.
But I've been turned around on this actually my weekly appearance on the Midweek Drive. Alex Lefchuk's top-notch program for Siren FM in the UK, which can be listened to at sirenonline.co.uk. Anyway, before my weekly appearance, Larry Nemesek was on the show. And he is an American Star Trek author, actor, editor, archivist, consultant, interviewer, producer, kind of the ultimate Star Trek fan and a key authority in the world of Star Trek and Star Trek fandom. And he was asked about my pessimism towards it, and he's an incredibly diplomatic guy, but he talked about why feelings towards the corporate handling of and the artistic handling of the movies should be separated from feelings about this project going forward. So I thought it might be interesting if I just play a 2-minute clip of Larry explaining that. And I introduce it by saying my most humble apologies to the Star Trek franchise.
Wow.
Phil was actually in one of his negative modes here because he actually uses this quote. Is it a case of the studio executives having their way with the dead carcass of Roddenberry's creation? I was a bit saddened by that, a bit shocked. Or is it just a case of, you know, adding on to that? I mean, do we need to? I mean, I was blessed and fortunate enough to meet Gene Roddenberry back in 1984, Larry. I find him a very cordial, very fine individual. But I could appreciate his irritation. He didn't want to go down the line of, shall we say, Irwin Allen, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I know it's a routine and so on. In fact, there were very few vegetables in Star Trek. Although, gah, obviously, it puts an appearance. But is that something where there's a kind of concern for Star Trek fans that actually, even including, obviously, Gene's son on the production staff of the new Star Trek TV series, you know, is it just a case of placating old fans?
I don't think so. I mean, for one thing, people make monolithic things out of Star Trek. They always have. Where there used to be different arms of the studio. You know, there was production, but then we'd have home video and licensing and publicity. I mean, and now, since what I call the Viacom divorce, you know, 10 years ago when Mama CBS got the TV, you know, main custody, and Paramount, the movie daddy, got visitation every 3 or 4 years, and up till now has done the cool thing with the kids, and the mom has kind of ignored it, for one reason or another. Well, now we've got this streaming service coming, which I hope is not news to your listeners. Mm-hmm. I hope everybody's up with that. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to the J.J. movies were born out of decisions made in 06 and 07, and that was one path. And then nothing was really done with it, and now the streaming service is back here. And the fact that they've gotten Brian Fuller and Nick Meyer, who both worked various aspects on the show, plus Rod and his business partner, Rod Roddenberry and his business partner, Trevor Roth, I think that's way more than just window dressing. I know having Brian Fuller as the showrunner, it's more than just a PR swipe. I'm really excited.
I like to feel it's infinite diversity in infinite combinations, Larry. That's the key thing, which will lead to wonderfulness.
I love how that opens with Alex saying, Phil was in one of his negative modes.
How many do you have negative modes?
Varying shades of gray to black. So
right.
One thing that I'll just put a button on this is I do appreciate that by launching a new streaming service with this Star Trek, there's a way that this feels, just like an idea that was come up by corporate. But at the same time, Star Trek truly is, at least on a technology and platform base, boldly going again. As opposed to these movies, which become, with greater and greater frequency, an exploration of places that every action franchise already goes ahead of them. So anyway, again, my apologies. But speaking of Star Trek, Dean, I don't know if you saw this, but William Shatner, who seems to come out with books more frequently than L. Ron Hubbard did at his height, had a book about Leonard Nimoy come out on the one-year anniversary of Nimoy's death.
Yeah.
And something that was interesting in it was that Shatner confides that they had a falling out and did not speak at all during the final years of Nimoy's life.
Right. And he couldn't figure out why.
Right.
What he said?
Apparently it had a falling out to do with that documentary, The Captains, that Shatner did, where Nimoy didn't want to be a part of it and Shatner didn't believe him. So Shatner sent a film crew to just go bum rush him. But
And then bum rushed him again at a convention in Vegas, like continually just hassling him to get him in the shows.
So that's sad. And yet, what really was powerful to me to think about was when Shatner says in this book, he refers to Leonard Nimoy as the only friend he ever had. And we know, there's a lot of stories about Shatner, being difficult and standoffish and ego-driven and all this. But what I want to focus on is how interesting it is that an actor who feels like he never had a friendship with anyone. In fact, he says that the Leonard Nimoy friendship did not happen really until they were making the movies. So in the 80s, it wasn't born out of the 60s. It was the movies and then all the fan conventions thereafter. But how astonishing that an actor who would not know friendship in real life would be part of two of the most indelible friendships ever depicted in the visual art form. Because when you think about Kirk and Spock, and you think about his Denny Crane with Alan Shore on Boston Legal, these are two of really the indelible friendships. And as I say often in my acting class, friendship chemistry is not often talked about or thought about. It is so much more difficult to accomplish than romantic chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can always fake sexual heat.
Yeah.
But to actually,
you get two people, you get a man and a woman who don't like each other intensely, and that reads like sexual attraction.
Yeah, for sure.
That tension, absolutely. Because it's about tension. But to believe that these two people have an easygoing, intimate rapport that is non-sexual is very tough, right?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's one of the reasons why so many people, you included, were disappointed that they had to explore the idea of a romantic relationship between Mulder and Scully, right? Because you don't get such believable friendships on television or in films that often. And isn't it worth, you know, and I'm putting words into your mouth, but isn't it worth preserving that?
Yeah. And keeping that as an example of, you know, isn't that harder and more, I don't know if it's harder for the actor,
I'm not saying that it is ironic. It no doubt Shatner's ability to embrace friendship in these fictional realms is in some way informed by his inability to do it, to be able to trust, to be able to open. As he says, I just always thought people wanted something from me. Right. You know, and so he was able to embrace those aspects of himself in these fictional realms where it would be safe, where that kind of intimacy is safe. So it's rather extraordinary. I was really moved by that. You know, speaking of Star Trek and the new technology it's exploring, did you see the announcement from Lionsgate and Comic-Con? That they are teaming on a VOD service that will make everybody's geeky dreams come true.
Wow.
They are to be beta testing it in the days leading up to Comic-Con for free, and then it'll be a paid service, and you will have access, all access, from your internet-connected device to all of San Diego Comic-Con. So if you're waiting all those hours out there in Hall H or whatever it is, you know, you could be at home enjoying a 64-ounce Big Gulp and watching Hall H streaming video.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that saves my trip to San Diego this year. I'm not even going to bother.
You know, speaking of the midweek drive of which we were speaking, I referred to, much to the dismay of some of the younger presenters, who, like many people, loves their Star Wars The Force Awakens. And I referred to it as being soulless.
Yes.
And of course, as you know, I actually enjoyed the experience of watching it much more than you did. Right?
Much more than I did.
But my point was that this was soulless. And it reminded me, actually, as soon as I was done having that conversation, of a conversation you and I had a long time ago, it feels like now, but about the difference between artist versus genius. Of course, some people could be both artist and genius.
Yes.
You get into maybe a conversation about a Leonardo da Vinci at that point, right?
Absolutely.
But that there is a difference. And I was thinking about kind of a third element of this, right? There are, if I keep the Michelangelo and Da Vinci going, there are painters, there are artists, there are geniuses. You can be more than one, but most people are one without being any of the others. You know, to me, right, a painter is someone who is, that's their avocation, that's their occupation. They are a professional painter.
Painters.
But that does not make them an artist.
Right. They do technically proficient work that can be enjoyed, a la, let's say, Thomas Kincaid.
Well, nice. I was thinking of the poem, the Andrea del Sarto poem, right? A man's reach.
Oh, yeah.
A man's reach should exceed his grasp, right? Mm. It's about a painter who's quite proficient and quite popular because he always stays well within his grasp. His ambition is always easily attained, which is, you know, part of the definition of being an artist is that idea that your reach should exceed your grasp from time to time, because
and
that shows you shows you what you're made of,
absolutely,
right? And it teaches you, and you go on to bigger and better work. To me, a genius is someone who utterly sees the world and perhaps the art form itself, and maybe both, in an utterly unique way,
right. And reaches for that and can only express himself in that way. You know, every painting, regardless of how you try to change your technique or whatever, has a fingerprint that is unique to you. And no matter how many classes you take and how many times you try refine whatever you're doing, your paintings will always have your DNA in it. And this is why art forgery and art historians can verify with it, without a doubt, that which paintings are belonging to which artist, because these are unique brushstrokes. So that genius that you say comes from that innate DNA that comes from every creative process.
Yeah, well, I think when we talked about this before, I vaguely recall certainly David Lynch being a part of this. And I think right. We came to a certain common ground where we both agreed that David Lynch, so in this conversation, it would be there are filmmakers and there are artists and there are geniuses, right? And I think right. We both agreed that David Lynch is without a doubt an artist.
Yes.
Probably not a genius. right?
Yeah.
And
right.
You would argue maybe not even a filmmaker.
Maybe not a filmmaker.
Yeah.
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 I would suggest.
Right? So, yeah. But still an artist.
Absolutely. Using different mediums and techniques to form whatever he's trying to express.
And to explore what he wants to explore. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I see it as, you know, a pot of spaghetti against the wall, and whatever sticks, he declares what his that was his intention. I, you know, I see a backwards structural ability to his work.
So why?
Whereas you see him as forward thinking.
So why I think of this in the wake of, you know, referring to and really hitting. I think that well. I absolutely hit the nail on the head with Star Wars The Force Awakens for how I feel about it and what I feel is lacking. It is soulless. That's what it is to me. But I thought about this because I was thinking about J.J. Abrams and I was thinking about the Star Trek movies and Star Wars and his remake of The Host, right? Cloverfield and really his TV work even. And he is a better filmmaker than George Lucas ever was. Truly,
yeah.
He is an accomplished and skilled filmmaker with a range of tools at his disposal, far better developed and far more versatile than Mr. Lucas ever developed.
That I agree with that 100%.
And yet, J.J. Abrams will never be the artist that George Lucas was, because George Lucas really was. It's so easy to write off him as just a brilliant businessman. But when
right.
you think, if you just take THX,
1138,
American Graffiti,
yeah,
Star Wars, and you know the incredible bringing to life of ancient mythological patternings, breathing new
yeah.
life into them in a way that would resonate with entire generations. There's real artistry in that. And
yeah.
And of course, his concept for Raiders of the Lost Ark, for Indiana Jones, which really, to me, brought the soul to that franchise.
Yeah,
Here, there's just been an announcement that, you know, Disney announced officially that Indiana Jones 5 will be coming. And I have no problem with that. I'm kind of, you know, happy about that. I don't care how old Harrison Ford gets. An archaeologist doesn't have to stop because he's a certain age, you know?
Right, exactly.
Ideally, maybe we'll get to a place where he's using knowledge and inventiveness and wit and whimsy to accomplish things that he used to accomplish with a gun and a bullwhip, right?
Yeah,
that might
yeah.
be really nice. But anyway, you know, give it a chance. And of course, Harrison Ford's back and Steven Spielberg's back. Frank Marshall and Kathleen Kennedy will be producing, but no involvement from the retired George Lucas, who sold his properties and Lucasfilm to Disney. And I just have a hard time not being fearful that that with Lucas's absence, so too will any chance of a soul be absent from an Indiana Jones 5. I do not like any of the prequel films for Star Wars. I think they are dreadful, dreadful
yeah.
movies, and yet, interestingly enough, they do all have a soul to them.
Fascinating. That is true. They're a soulful mess, really.
Yeah. And that soul feels surrounded. I mean, those movies are almost Darth Vader themselves. It's interesting about it's the becoming of Darth Vader, but it's a soul trapped in all this immovable technology.
Yeah, and executives and commanders around you telling you what to do and all that sort of thing. Clearly, there was a ton of executives test marketing little bits of it too, and parts of it farmed out to other CGI firms and stuff like that. Like, yeah, it was disjointed, but you're right. There is a soul trapped in all three of them, actually, across the board.
I want to talk about a couple of films here while we have a few minutes. I mentioned how much I enjoyed Hail Caesar, how much I think you'll enjoy Hail Caesar.
Can't wait to see it.
I have become quite disturbed at how easily dismissed Hail Caesar will be from people. From the one hand, saying it's light, Coen Brothers, to other people thinking that it doesn't really have anything going on. It disturbs me so much, again, the lack of literacy on the part of movie audiences and on the part of people who make movies, the lack of literacy. Here is a movie that, to me, embodies exactly the clever truth that it's getting at, which is, namely, that people of great faith, people of great spirituality, and people of great political consciousness were able to get a surprising amount of powerful messages into these corporate creations, which were called movies during the golden age of Hollywood. And that these messages that got into those movies without the overlords knowing it really did change a lot of hearts and minds around the world. And so here's a movie by the Coen brothers that depicts that era that so many people are willing to just dismiss as, oh, it's so frothy and so light. Why don't they do something meaningful again? Which is exactly the attitude that people had about those Hollywood films. And now we look back and we go, wow.
Hey, wait. There was
how'd they get away with that?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So you're saying that there is a whole political undercurrent to Hail Caesar.
There is a surprising amount of message in this film. So maybe, I don't know. We've talked about it before. We've said maybe we'd do The Swimmer. I don't know if we'll have time when you were here for a brief stay. Maybe we will. But
maybe.
Wouldn't it be fun to do our what we did with the X-Files, I Want to Believe, and do a subtextual reading of another movie at some point.
Ah, yeah, I would love that.
And it would be fun if it was something that, like a Hail Caesar, where we can bring a lot of reading to it from a historic perspective,
right.
Where it is a standalone piece, as opposed to The X-Files, which, like we said, and had to go through, had all of this mythology, but also the baggage that comes with ongoing characters and audience attachment to it. But so maybe a Hail Caesar or something would be a fun one.
I like it. I like it.
In the future. I mentioned Dope, that Roger Guinevere Smith was one of the stars of. This was an independent film that came out last summer nationwide. We talked about it then, how the buzz was great for it, but they released it at a time and in a way as counter-programming where they needed this thing to make like $20 million to break even because they launched it so big and didn't give it a chance to. So it opened to $6 million, which is incredible for an independent film. And
that nobody's heard of. Yeah,
yeah, and you spent $20 million to make your $6 million. So it got a little bit buried. But it's a funny enough movie. It's set in South Central. It's about some isolated outsiders in a high school, black kids who are enamored of 90s culture. It's sent present day, and they're enamored of 90s culture. So it's a fun little fish out of water story that crosses into kind of the de rigueur drug storyline of the 90s. Like, they're living in their own 90s film.
Right.
You know, not exactly up my particular alley, but I can understand why people enjoyed it. Although, I think, again, people make these movies thinking, oh, the kids are going to love this. But really, it's people my age that are going to watch this. That's it. Kids are not going to do it.
Right.
And indeed, it's written and directed by, you know, a middle-aged guy. But I bring it up because I wanted to ask you about this, and maybe this is where we'll end the show. One of the key plot points in it are the usage of bitcoins in illegal enterprise. I've got to be honest with you. I've been aware of what bitcoins were until this movie came about, or I watched this movie. I didn't really realize how little I knew about bitcoins. And I figure you're the guy to ask about this. So give me a primer on maybe what bitcoins are for anyone who's listening who is drawing a blank right now. But also, you know, how are they used? It seems to me really the only reason you would use them is for illegal activity.
Absolutely.
But give me bitcoins 101, Dean Haglund.
Yeah, originally it's a virtual currency that you trade online. And now I think like Starbucks in New York and there's a few other places that take bitcoins. And it is it's a fixed number of assets. And you use a data miner or no, a bitcoin miner to gather your bitcoins. So the idea is that, A, they don't know who created it. So it's kind of a open source on an open market thing where you mine for your coins, as it were, and then they have a value that goes up and down on an exchange rate, and then you can exchange it for goods and services like you could. But it is untraceable because it's virtual. So it's perfect for all of ISIS is using it. It is a it's big in the drug underworld and terrorist activities, but it's also used in legitimate online things like, you know, gaming and stuff like
Except
that.
Except that it can't be taxed, can it?
It can't be taxed because it's a virtual thing. So only if you exchange it for dollars that you put in a bank account does it become taxable because of its – I forget why it can't be taxed. The IRS – you know, as always, any virtual currency, it's sort of like, you know, if you play World of Warcraft or any one of those things and you have a big stack of World of Warcraft coins and you can buy things in World of Warcraft and people make, you know, six digits a year just making virtual items for online gaming environments, they're traded just in those virtual coins of that game. But then ultimately you can go on eBay and you can sell off those coins for real money, at which point you're taxed for a e-good, as it would be called. So, but bitcoins stay within the virtual world, and they always stay within the virtual world, but their value fluctuates from time to time. So it's a hard thing to get your head around. I know in the internal audit world, they are all up in a tizzy about it because it is very hard to audit and find the trail of this stuff because it doesn't leave a paper trail. So it's a tricky thing. And, you know, coming from the world of open source and Linux and all that sort of thing, it's in that headset that originally was created, though now because of its, not cloak and dagger, but of its ability to transect many different cultures and stuff like that, it seems to be gravitating towards the nefarious.
I'm surprised that I have not come across Bitcoin usage in more motion picture storylines, plot lines. I really am. You know, that it was that it's a comedy, a drug comedy about high school kids where it would come out is kind of an interesting thing.
That is interesting because, you know, theoretically, I mean, your MacGuffin is always a big bag of cash that gets blown up and bills go everywhere,
right,
and that
right.
looks great. And to just go, oh, I tap a few things on the keyboard, and there you go, you have your $200 million. not as exciting.
That brings us to an end of another, we hope, exciting, action-packed installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. How,
yes.
And dare I say, your influential Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Why do I say that? Well, I don't believe in coincidences, you know, Dean Haglund. And
I know.
A few weeks ago, we were raving about the work of young actor Taron Egerton, the young lead in last year's The Kingsman, this year's Eddie the Eagle. Over the last few weeks, I, of course, have championed Hail Caesar, and I especially singled out the scene-stealing turn by young Alden Ehrenreich, who plays a Western star become kind of one of those drawing room black tie kind of movie stars. He is just unbelievably great in Hail Caesar. We champion him on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Along with Taron Egerton, and what do you know, next thing you find out, you read headlines that the two of them are among the three finalists to be cast as young Han Solo in the new Star Wars films. So, indeed, it's from our lips to Disney's ears. It's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. We've told you how you can find every episode at chillpackhollywood.com. Please follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil.
Yep. Like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We want to talk about what you want us to talk about. That's one of the things we mean when we say it is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. As always, we're hosted by the good people at Blog Talk Radio. And
thank you.
We are sponsored by Empire State Gas, the only organically grown and independently owned gas in the Northeast United States. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then. Continental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.